Is it on? Okay, great. Thank you very much. So I'd like to talk to you about the kinetic modeling of collisionless shocks and trying to relate the plasma physics of the microscopic scale of the transition of the shock to something that we can infer from astronomical observations. So my collaborators are listed here. A lot of work was done by postdoc in my group, Damiana Caprioli and Jaycon Park, and several undergrads who worked with us over the summers. So the gallery of various appearances of collisionless shocks in astrophysics is quite diverse. They range not only from shocks in the solar wind, but also include supernova remnants, which is the reason we are here, and extend all the way out to relativistic sources, where you can have shocks in jets of active galactic nuclei or gamma ray bursts. So despite this large range of scales, velocities, and parameters, they all seem to show some similar effects. So in particular, they are all typically collision-less, meaning that the mean free path for Coulomb collisions between particles is much larger than the scales of interest. When we observe them, we infer that these shocks manage to do three simple things, which is accelerate particles, amplify magnetic fields, and somehow exchange energy between electrons and ions. And the big question is, of course, how do they do this, and what are the mechanisms involved in this? The particular application for supernova remnants that we're all interested in is the synchrotron-emitting rims that we'll infer from them the thickness. From the thickness, we infer the significant amplification of magnetic field, much more than the compression at the shock. And also, by modeling the non-thermal emission, we infer the energies of accelerated electrons and also infer the potential modifications of the shock due to cosmic ray acceleration. So we infer up to 100 TeV energy of electrons and maybe 10 to 40% of energy dumped into cosmic rays. So also there is interesting inferences about equilibration between electron and ion temperatures. So the trick between electrons and ions is that the scale on which the shock typically happens is the scale of the Larmor radius of the ion, which is much larger than the Larmor radius of a typical electron. So electrons and ions have a much disparate scales that they need to cross in order to enter the acceleration process. So that's something that enters into the physics. So the questions we're trying to address here is, what is the structure of these shocks? Do they exist? And what are the mechanisms of particle acceleration? Is it Fermi mechanism, or there are some need for other mechanisms? And also, the main question is efficiency. So these diffusive shock acceleration is a nice theory. It predicts a nice power law, which is quite generic. What it doesn't predict is normalization of the power law. And in order to understand that, you need the microphysics. So because the microphysics connects turbulence at the shock to the properties of the overall structure of the shock and the acceleration. So this is this triangle of magnetic turbulence, particle acceleration, and shock structure, and they're all interrelated. They all can feed back into each other. Typically, what happens is you have from a hydrodynamic point of view, you have a very thin transition between the upstream and the downstream in the shock, and on the microscopic scale, there are various ugly plasma instabilities living there, and what they do is that they reflect and inject some part of the flow into this acceleration process. So we have this kind of a cloud of cosmic rays, that I will call them, that can diffuse around the shock and extend quite a ways away from the transition. And these cosmic rays can change the structure of the shock because they can amplify magnetic field. This field propagates through the shock and can ultimately smooth out a shock in a large scale. So the way we try to simulate this is starting from first principles, where we just model the plasma physics directly using particles. So we discretize a plasma as a bunch of particles moving on grids. The particles have charge as they move around, feeling the electromagnetic field from the Maxwell's equations on the grid. They experience Lorentz force. They can move through the grid. We record their currents and then use those currents to advance Maxwell equations on. So this is called a particle-in-cell method. It's very robust, it works, it's very expensive. So if you want to do a very large problem, this is not the best method to use, although it is brutally efficient and it does give the answer. A simplification is what we call a hybrid simulation, where we only use ions, only use kinetic particles for ions, and for electrons, we assume that they're shorting out, that they're providing the V cross B electric fields, and for electrons, we can use fluid equations. So this allows us to speed up the simulation at the expense of dropping the physics of electrons. So what we've been doing over the last few years is kind of a survey of the different shock conditions to see whether there are interesting patterns emerging. So our typical setup is we have a flow that's supersonic. It hits a wall, and it carries with it magnetic field, which we can vary the inclination and the strength of. And then as it hits the wall, you get a shock that propagates this way. So this wall really represents a contact discontinuity between, say, ejecta and an ISM. So we don't model the contact discontinuity. We just model the forward shock. So the main parameter that we find that determines the physics is what we call magnetization, or sigma, or the ratio of magnetic energy to the kinetic energy in the flow. It also has a relationship to Alphanic Mach number. So it's roughly inverse Alphanic Mach number squared. So large magnetization means low Mach numbers, low Alphanic Mach numbers. And small magnetization means high Alphanic Mach numbers. So our typical findings is that the mechanism of the shock physics depends on the magnetization, on how strong the magnetic field is. And then we also see examples of a particle acceleration in various environments, including in the relativistic shocks, which I will not mention. And more recently, we've had acceleration in non-relativistic shocks. We see both ion acceleration and electron acceleration. And we can quantify it as a function of Mach number and the obliqueness of the shock, or the direction of the magnetic field with respect to the flow motion. So there are two main mechanisms that delineate how physics of the shock, of collisional shock, works. This physics changes as a function of the Alphanic Mach number or magnetization. So if the magnetic field is very, very weak, or Alphanic Mach numbers are higher than 100, then if you try to have upstream go through the downstream, they will try to go through each other, and there will be instabilities that generated. So there will be streaming instabilities. One of them is called Weibull instability, but there's a bunch of streaming filamentation type instabilities, which create small-scale magnetic fields, which deflect particles and let them go back around the shock. So these kind of filamentary type shocks are what happens at a very high Alphanic Mach number. At more moderate Alphanic Mach number, magnetic field carried by the flow is important, and then what happens is that the particles feel a compression in the magnetic field, and instead of just going on an E cross B drift on a straight line, they start gyrating like this on an E cross B drift in the compressed magnetic field. And this kind of gyration slows down the flow, makes a higher density here, and that's how a magnetized shock works. So mainly I'll be focusing on these guys. And then, so this is just shown for the perpendicular magnetic field, where magnetic field is perpendicular to the direction of the flow. In principle, you can change the angle, and then there will be interesting implications. So let me show you how these shocks work from the inside. This is a particle-in-cell simulation. What's shown here is the integrated density. So the initially, it's 75-degree inclination of the magnetic field to the direction of the flow, fairly low Alphanic Mach number. And you see here the density profile, and this is the momentum space of the ions. So I'll use this kind of plots further on. So what this shows is this is velocity or momentum along the x direction. So this shows negative velocity going that way, and the spread is very small. This means that this is a supersonic flow. Supersonic flow coming in, it hit a wall somewhere there, and then you see a shock propagating this way. So this is a hot ions behind the shock, and this is the shock transition where you see the density jump, and there is interesting gyrations of ions that happen. So this is how this works in a time-dependent way. You can see that there is periodic gyrations in this shock transition. You can see electrons get very heated up. Also, you can see the structure of the magnetic fields here. So this is density, this is magnetic energy, this is out-of-plane magnetic field. What you see is that the field gets compressed. There is overshoots of magnetic field corresponding to these density compressions. You also see interesting waves radiated around the shock. These are called Whistler waves. They may be important for trapping electrons and accelerating electrons, as we'll discuss. So we see a considerable amount of energy equilibration between ions and electrons. So the kinetic energy of ions and electrons, this is electron, this is ions. And you can see that they start out with most of the kinetic energy in the ions, and eventually, after the shock, it gets almost to equipartitional, factor of two. So this is... This was low Mach number, this is higher Mach number, what you see here is that there are interesting kind of filamentary structures that appear. This is this physics of low magnetization shocks comes back, so these filamentary structures of Weibull instability are important. However, after a while, the magnetic field is still there, it still remembers the magnetic field, and you can have this magnetic compression propagating. So these shocks still function ultimately as magnetic, although there is some interesting structures in between. This is what I call a quasi-parallel shock. So here the magnetic field is initially along the direction of the flow. you can see that the shock still happens. There is still density jump. There is a bit of an extra compression that it gets to the final shock jumps as it needs behind this first subshock. What you can see is that there is considerable amount of ions going back towards the upstream, so they can escape along this magnetic field, and this is going to be important for particle acceleration. Also, you can see that there are interesting transverse waves that are being created in front of the shock. So we already see hints of this in particle and cell simulation. So these are waves driven by these ions coming back towards the upstream. They're actually circularly polarized if we plot it in both X, Y, and Z components. We see a lot of equilibration in this case. So the lesson from these quasi-perpendicular, quasi-parallel shocks is that quasi-perpendicular shocks, show almost no reflection of ions into the upstream. So here is a phase space. You don't see anybody in this region, which is positive momentum, meaning moving in front of the shock. If you have quasi-parallel shock, you do have returning streams of ions coming back toward the upstream, and they drive interesting turbulence, and this is the recipe for particle acceleration. So these shocks are going to be good for returning particles back to the upstream, coming back to the downstream, and gaining energy. As you can see already, that the momenta are increasing towards the shock as there is particle acceleration happening. So the two ingredients that are necessary for shock acceleration is that the shock is able to send particles back towards the upstream. This typically happens on first crossing of the shock. Usually the leakage from downstream almost never happens. So particles never go through the shock and then decide that they want to outrun the shock. Never happens. What does happen is that on the first crossing, particles get reflected and sent back into the upstream. So there are interesting conditions when this occurs. And then once they're back in the upstream, they need turbulence to come back. If there is no turbulence, they won't come back, and you won't get an interesting accelerator. So you need this either pre-existing or self-generated turbulence in the upstream. And what we're finding is that parallel shocks are good for both ion and electron acceleration. Perpendicular shocks mainly seem to be accelerating electrons, and they don't seem to be accelerating ions. So this is just the broad brush strokes ideas, but there are very interesting sub-regimes that we're finding, and I don't think the whole picture is fully mapped yet. So we kind of feel like blind man describing an elephant, and we're poking here and there, and we see general trends, but I don't think we have a full picture yet. Okay, so let me run through some of these physics of proton injection and physics of electron injection. If I have time, I'll get to heavy ions and reacceleration of cosmic rays. So proton acceleration. So here we switch to hybrid simulations, which allow us longer evolution time and to see the final formation of the power law tail. What you see, this is a density and this is magnetic field out of plane of a two-dimensional hybrid simulation. Initially, magnetic field is along the direction of the flow. You see some representative particles coming in, scattering off the shock and coming back towards the upstream. You can see that they're getting energy because their tails are becoming larger. This is their Larmor gyrations around the they're on the field direction. You also see that the field is getting amplified. You see these waves in front of the shock. These waves are driven by returning particles going back towards the upstream. So this is the evolution of the spectrum. When we run hybrid simulation, we can actually push it to long time, and we can see the formation of a real DSA spectrum. So this is a non-relativistic simulation, so what I'm plotting here is in non-relativistic case, the energy spectrum is e to the minus 1.5. It's still p to the minus 4 in momentum space, but in energy it's e to the minus 1.5. So here I multiply it by e to the 1.5. And you can see that over time, as the redder is the later time, the spectrum gets closer to the p to the minus 4 DSA prediction. So we get really Fermi acceleration going on. Also, not non-trivial amount of energy goes into this tail, so that energy comes from the downstream temperature. So the downstream temperature is actually shifted from what you would expect naively, but overall energy conservation is there, so that's good. So we're putting some energy from the thermal into the cosmic rays. Okay, we see evidence of magnetic field amplification associated with this acceleration. So the idea is that as these cosmic rays are flying around the shock, they will be pushed through the upstream with the shock, and that will be a net current. And this current is driving a non-resonant Bell's instability, which amplifies magnetic field. Indeed, that's what we're seeing here. So this is the density, and this is the magnetic energy through the shock. You can see that there is interesting filamentation starting to happen in front of the shock. This is cosmic rays trying to go through and drilling holes in the upstream. And these holes are a nonlinear evolution of the Bell's instability. So they're starting to amplify circularly polarized waves, which are getting nonlinear and expelling the density and creating these holes. As these holes are propagating through the shock, there is interesting extra turbulence that they're driving at the shock. But we see this evidence of magnetic field in the upstream getting larger with time. So we can plot this for different inclinations of the shock, and you can see that for quasi-parallel shocks, there is upstream turbulence. As they get more and more quasi-perpendicular, the turbulence shuts off. So for the efficient ones that do amplify magnetic fields, we see that the magnetic amplification factor scales with the Mach number, which is what we expect. So the more B-field amplification for stronger shocks. And we expect that from the theory of streaming instability in front of shocks. We can run this long enough to see the transition between the diffusive shock acceleration and escape of particles. So what's shown here is the magnetic field transfers to the flow. And this is the downstream region. This is what we call the DSA region. This is where diffusion happens. And this is what we call the far upstream or escaping region. So here, particles are mainly escaping. They're not diffusing. Thank you. We can quantify what instabilities happen here. Here it's mostly non-resonant instability, Bell's instability due to current. Here it's mostly resonant instability. As the non-resonant instability proceeds, this wavelength grows larger and eventually starts to trap cosmic rays. And when they're trapped, they're mostly resonant, and this is where diffusion happens. And then they go into the downstream. We can quantify the diffusion coefficient from the simulations. What we find is in efficiently accelerating shocks, it's consistent with being Bohm diffusion, but in the amplified magnetic field. So we're seeing energy dependence of diffusion coefficient consistent with Bohm diffusion. And similarly, the maximal energy seems to grow according to the DSA prediction. So depending on diffusion coefficient, we get linear growth of maximal energy with time. Okay, so the physics of this acceleration is that, so here's different inclination angles. For quasi-perpendicular shocks, we have almost no acceleration. There is a little bit of a bump here, and this is what we call the shock drift acceleration. So as particles come in, they can sit on the shock for a few cycles and then go back into downstream. And this kind of drifting along the shock gains some energy from the advection electric field. It's called the shock drift. And then for more parallel configurations, we get into diffusive acceleration. This is the energy efficiency of shocks of different Mach numbers. versus the inclination of the magnetic field. And what we find, again, is that the quasi-parallel shocks, which go up to about 45 degrees, we get good efficiencies, good acceleration of ions, and then it shuts off as we get to higher inclinations. So the typical number of injected particles here is around 1%. So 1% of ions gets into this tail. And it's interesting to answer, why does this actually happen? Why is this 1%? Why is it not 17%? And we dug into this a little bit more, and we looked carefully at what happens at a quasi-parallel shock, how the ions cross it. And here you can see the phase space of a quasi-parallel shock, and you can see that it has these periodic jumps. So this kind of phenomenon is periodic reformation of the shock transition happening on the gyro scale of the ions. And what we see is that there are some particles that manage to hang around the shock for a few of these cycles, and then they get larger energy as time goes on. So we quantified this by looking at different shells of particles propagating into the shock, and then looking at how efficiently they're injected into final acceleration process. So when they become purple, that means that those particles are eventually injected into the DSA process. And so this shell that's coming is going to be very efficient at being injected in the end. You can see that the injection efficiency varies with time at which the particles reach the shock. And you can see that there are special times when particles reflect in a very strong way and eventually can be injected. You can see that they gain energy, and every time they will continue moving at larger orbits, eventually becoming injected into the shock. So the shock injection seems to change with time, and it also seems to depend on the particular orientation of the magnetic field to the direction of the flow. So what is happening here is that particles need a minimal energy in order to start outrunning the shock along the magnetic field. And the larger the inclination of the shock, the higher that energy is. They need to move faster along the shock to outrun it. They gain energy through the shock drift acceleration cycles. And so if a particle needs more energy, it needs to stay longer on the shock during these shock drift cycles. And these cycles are leaky. The shock is not going to be accelerating forever for every particle, so some of them get lost into the downstream. So the more cycles it needs to be on the shock to get to particular energy, the more leaky it will be, the fewer particles will get there. And that's kind of what we see in the simulations. As the shock transition is moving, it represents a time-varying barrier to the particles, and particles that cross in a particular moment will get efficiently reflected back, but then they have to stay on the shock for several cycles in order to gain enough energy to outrun the shock. And the more oblique the shock is, the less likely they're going to end up accelerating to that energy. So let me skip this part. And indeed, we find this when we trace particles through the simulation. We see that there are three different populations. One is that they just cross through the shock and go into the downstream. This is the bulk of the particles. A few particles can hang around the shock and then still get advected into the downstream. And a few can bounce around the shock, gain energy, and then get injected back into the upstream. And then those particles are eventually participating in the DSA. And the relative fraction between them is determined by how often the shock presents the opportune moment for the particles to be injected. So this the duty cycle of when the shock is in the right state to inject particles. Okay, and these three different populations show in this transition between Maxwellian and the non-thermal tail. Okay, so what we find is that more oblique shocks require more of these SDA cycles, shock drift acceleration, and therefore they will have smaller injection. And that's kind of what we're finding in the simulation. Let me talk about electron acceleration. So electrons, as I mentioned, are difficult because they have small Larmor radii. And only fairly recently we've been able to run large enough simulations. Now you have to use particle in cell because you need both electrons and protons. We have to run a large enough simulation to see both ion and electron acceleration happen at the same time. So this is ion phase space of a quasi-parallel shock. You can see that ions are eventually doing what we expect. They start accelerating, they drive waves. And as you see these waves appearing in the upstream, you start seeing electron acceleration. So what happens here is that these waves driven by the ions are of the right polarization. They're non-resonant with the ions, therefore they're resonant with electrons, to start trapping electrons and sending them back to the shock and gaining, allowing them to accelerate. So eventually you start seeing electron acceleration being created through the interaction with the waves created by the ions. So it's an interesting bootstrapping effect where ions are causing electrons to get energy. And we can, if you run it long enough, we can see a tail in the ions start to develop and then a tail in the electrons. And what's interesting here is that we can take the ratio and ask what is the injection, what is the relative injection efficiency between electrons and protons. And so by taking the ratio between different components in the power law stage. What we find is that, so this is the range of our simulations, we vary mass ratio, we start with artificial mass ratio, trying to push it more closer to reality. And we typically find this on the order of 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 2 is our ratio between electrons and protons, which seems to be in the range between the observations at Earth and what people infer from modeling supernova remnants. And the reason it's small is because electrons have a handicap. They need to go through several of these shocks, drift acceleration cycles, get scattered on the ion waves, come back, do more shock drift, get scattered on the ion waves, and so forth. So they have a harder time going through all of these hoops, so fewer electrons survive ultimately. Okay, and we've recently had more evidence that the quasi-perpendicular shocks, the ones that don't accelerate ions, do manage to quite easily send electrons back towards the upstream. But what's difficult for those electrons is to actually get trapped and come back, because usually there is not much turbulence in the upstream to cause the electrons to return to the shock. And if you run simulations for a really long time, we can start seeing that even electron-driven waves start reflecting electrons back towards the shock and getting them accelerated. So here you can see these shocks where the ions don't show much acceleration, but electrons seem to start producing their own tail. So this is interesting bootstrapping of electrons on themselves. And in these cases, we find less than 1% by number, 0.1 to 4% by energy, but I think this is still, these numbers are still not final. It's clear that quasi-perp shocks are less efficient in acceleration than quasi-parallel shocks, but how exactly, what the exact number is not yet clear. Okay, so let me skip this. So the emerging picture is that when we have no initial turbulence, shocks in the laminar field, quasi-parallel shocks seem to accelerate both ions and electrons. Quasi-perpendicular shocks seem to be accelerating mostly electrons. And we think this seems to be responsible for some properties of young supernova remnants. So for example, if you have a supernova remnant like 1006 here, idea is that these regions are probably quasi-parallel, so they're good at accelerating protons, which then bootstrap electrons, and that what you see here is the shock would become quasi-perpendicular here because it will become turbulent as ions are driving their waves. It's going to be a turbulent quasi-perpendicular shock. It's going to inject a lot of electrons here, and this is what we're seeing in these rims, electron acceleration. And then this would favor on the large scale to have radial magnetic fields in this direction. And this seems to be confirmed from the radio observations, where there is measurements of the angle of the magnetic field to the shock normal, and also the rate of polarization, which low polarization means more turbulent magnetic field. So these regions seem to be coincided with more turbulence and overall large-scale field being sent in that direction. Okay, so let me skip this part. Let me just finish on this thing. This is a fun thing we've been doing recently, is looking at other species besides protons and seeing how they accelerate. So in cosmic ray data, there is interesting evidence that species with large A over Z, large A, so high mass species, seem to be preferentially present in cosmic rays compared to the solar distribution. And This could be because they're preferentially injected at shocks. So we tried looking at this, and unfortunately, most of the ions in the fully ionized elements have A over Z of 2, so there isn't much preference in their injections. What we do is when we look at the cosmic composition and have hydrogen, helium, xenon, and iron, we do see that the maximal energy grows with the charge of the particles. That's fine. But the relative injection does not seem to be enhanced. So we don't see much preferential injection of iron compared to, say, hydrogen. But if we start accelerating ions that are not fully ionized, so if you have just, let's say, singly ionized ion, then you can have a large range of A over Zs. And then that can actually change the injection efficiency. So what we find is that if we look at singly ionized species, so hydrogen, deuterium, and helium here, and helium is this one. And we look at their spectra, what we find over time is that the particles with larger A over Z get more efficiently injected. And this is because they have larger Larmor radii, so in principle they can sample both upstream and the downstream in an easier fashion. And they also get more chances to scatter. While low A over Z particles only have to scatter right off the shock, larger A over Z particles can go far into the downstream and then scatter on multiple waves before they can get back to the upstream. And as we run this simulation longer, we see that this tail seems to evolve with time. Let me speed it up a little bit. And let me just show this. So what you see here is that the large A over Z particles seem to have a larger injection fraction, so up to factors of 50 in what we're doing here, which seems to be, you know, an interesting suggestion that perhaps cosmic rays are being picked up from the ISM and they're starting at the low ionization fraction, and that potentially can explain the high fractions we see in cosmic rays. Okay, so let me conclude with the last slide. Obviously, we're doing very small-scale simulations, but we're trying to extrapolate them to large scales. And at face value, it seems crazy to do this, but on the other hand, there is no other way, because real physics involves injection, and injection has to happen on small scales, and we need to understand these small scales. But already in these simulations, we see 10-20% of energy injected into protons in efficient accelerators. We can measure kappa EP of around 10 to the minus 3, and we get the DSA spectrum of P to the minus 4. All right, I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Anatoly. We have a time for a couple of quick questions. One here. And Vikram, second.
Thanks for the presentation.
Sorry.
Thanks for the...
You can project.
Thanks again for the, once again, great presentation. You mentioned something about the equilibration earlier.
Yes.
Is there anything new on that that you have?
Right. So we do see a lot of equilibration. So this is, let's see. So quasi-perpendicular, low Mach number shock, higher Mach number shock, and quasi-parallel shock. And what we find is that we usually get more than 10%, always we get more than 10% energy going into electrons. We never get less than 10%.
Okay,
for quasi-parallel shocks, sorry. It's almost 100%.
So many of us have been studying shocks in which the upstream medium is partially neutral. Have you thought about how you would simulate that?
Well, there will be extra drags, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, we can add more physics. It's no problem adding more physics. My problem is I don't understand the simple case. I usually try to walk before I run, but it's certainly something that can be added.
Victor?
Hi. Okay, so actually that was part of the question I had. I was wondering about, you know, What happens to acceleration itself in a partially ionized medium? Like, you know, how would it change if your medium was partially ionized? And have you even, I guess you've not tried that, but I don't know how it would affect your simulations. And one more thing is, what are the kind of magnetic fields, amplification numbers that you can think you can get for the high Mach number shocks and stuff?
Sorry, the question is...
What are the magnetic field amplification? Oh, right. How much can you get for high Mach number shocks? And what's the highest Mach number you've tried?
Yeah, so we were seeing amplifications of at least 20 or 30 for Mach numbers around 80 or so.
And the first part about the ionization?
I haven't done it. We can do it with hybrid simulation, and there is some work on it, but I personally have not worked on that. It's an extra complication. I'd rather not think of it right now.
And the last question at the back.
Hi. So if I understood correctly, you're saying that electrons are less efficiently accelerated than ions because electrons go through these multiple shock drift cycles. Yes. And they lose energy at each of these cycles. So my question is...
We lose number at every one of those cycles.
Sorry?
There are fewer getting... It's lossy cycles. They don't lose energy, we lose numbers.
Okay, I see. So are these lossy cycles, like, do they depend on the property of the shock, like the Mach number of the shock?
Yes.
Or the magnetic field? And do you know how, like, how the losses scale with the shock?
Right. So, for strong shocks, what matters is the energy gain. And the energy gain per cycle depends on the compression ratio of the shock. So, if you're in a strong shock limit, they're all pretty much the same. If you're in a low Mach number limit, then the compression ratio will change, and you will have fewer electrons being accelerated. So, at low Mach number, you will have lesser efficiency, but at strong Mach number, it will saturate.
Okay, let's thank Anatoly once again. Oh, there is one more question. I'm sorry.
One of the predictions of most diffuse shock acceleration models is that there should be ahead of the shock an X-ray halo or something, and yet attempts to observe such a thing, certainly in Tittle 6, which is probably the best place to do this, have really failed to find such a thing. Do your models address this at all?
In principle, yes. Right. So, I mean, we have spectra upstream of the shock, and we have, we can predict synchrotron spectra in front of the shock. Obviously, they're not very long simulations, but we don't have any ionization models or any kind of excitation, but I think that the simulations we saw in the first talk would be better addressed. You know, given the injection prescription we have here, they can be inputted into larger scales models like that. Yeah.
Okay, once again, thanks, Anatoly.